Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where each patient has a dedicated care manager to help coordinate every aspect of care, from scheduling appointments to transferring medical records and arranging transportation and accommodations at cancercenter.com.
River to River coming up in just a couple minutes on Iowa Public Radio. Host Ben Kiefer will be talking with the former FBI lead international kidnapping negotiator and native Iowan, Chris Voss. Temperatures across the state today are in the upper 80s to lower 90s, combined with humid conditions, and those conditions will produce the heat index readings of 95 to 100 this afternoon. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio. It's 11:59.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. If you came to me for advice about negotiating a deal and I told you yes is the last thing you want to hear from the person you're negotiating with, or that you should let emotion take center stage, or that compromise is the worst thing you can do, you'd probably think, well, I won't ask Ben again for any more advice. However, that's the type of counterintuitive wisdom my guest this hour would give you. For two decades, Chris Voss served as lead international hostage negotiator for the FBI. Now, he's one of the leading practitioners and professors of negotiation skills in the world. He's the founder and principal of the Black Swan Group. That's a consulting firm that provides training and advises Fortune 500 companies through complex negotiations. He also currently teaches at the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business and Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business. His new book is titled Never Split the Difference: Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. Oh, and one other thing, he's a native of Iowa. He grew up in Mount Pleasant. He's a graduate of Iowa State University and joins us for the entire hour. What a pleasure to have you with us, Chris Voss. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. My pleasure to be here. And of all the stuff that you listed, I think I'm proudest of being from Iowa.
All right. That's a good start. Hey, I'll ask you about that a little bit later in the hour. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things you describe in your book, and even before the strategies that you talk about in your book. I thought it was very interesting how you tell about a series of failed hostage negotiations forcing the FBI to reevaluate their strategies. Tell us a little bit about those strategies and that turning point.
Well, it really came when a particular kidnapping internationally turned out unexpectedly, and hostages died, and they were actually killed by friendly fire from in a botched rescue attempt. But at the time, I knew that we did everything that we knew how to do, and it wasn't enough. And instead of giving up, I thought, all right, so look, if what we know isn't enough, we got to look to outside sources. And so I ended up at Harvard Law School's negotiation course and negotiating there. And that was a real turning point in us getting better.
Mm-hmm. So what about that? What happened at the turning point? What did you discover?
Well, first of all, the difference between hostage negotiation and business negotiation is only really the stakes. You know, I mean, I like to say take the guns out of a typical bank robbery with hostages. I think you get a Monday morning staff meeting with the boss.
All right.
So, and then when I started realizing that the dynamics were the same, you know, we said, okay, so what really works great in business negotiations? And we really circled back on some stuff that we knew about before. We just didn't understand how to apply it. And it was really, you know, when you can ask a good question or what a good question is, it's usually a how or a what question. You know, the question, how am I supposed to do that, works with terrorists and it works with 13-year-olds. And then we looked at some other stuff that we knew, and we just got a great feel for applying emotional intelligence in everything and really using it effectively.
Mm-hmm. That's a point you make early on in the book, is that this shift from logic-based approaches to an approach that is more grounded in, as you said, emotional intelligence, psychology. So you would think logic would work in these situations rather than emotional. We're told don't get emotional if we're having an argument or a debate. Why doesn't logic-based approach work as well in some cases?
Yeah, you know, the crazy thing about logic is it's how our mind works, but as it turns out, it's not how anybody else's mind works. You know, they're illogical. We're the logical ones. And what it really boils down to is every decision we make, it's based on what we care about. which by definition makes every decision an emotional decision. The emotion of what you care about goes in there. And as you said before, you know, if you're in a discussion, somebody says you're emotional about this, that's an insult. In the same discussion, if I could say, well, you're passionate about this, that'd be compliment. So what's the difference between emotions and passions? It's all in how we look at it. And if you're willing to accept that emotions are the key tipping points in any decision, well, then you get really powerful in how you can interact with other people and have actually kind of a frightening amount of influence.
Mm-hmm. So give me an example of a situation that you would approach logically as opposed to emotionally, just so we have a feeling for the different approaches.
All right, and it goes right to what you said earlier, why yes is the last thing you want to hear. What you're really driving for in any given negotiation is you want to hear the other side say, that's right. And it happened first that I talk about in the book. There was a kidnapping in the Philippines where the terrorists were complaining about 500 years of oppression from the Spanish to the Japanese to the Americans in the south of the Philippines, and they're holding an American. So logic says, well, what difference, what does what the Spanish did 500 years ago have to do with the American that you're holding now? That's illogical. And no matter how many times we made that case, they didn't change their mind or their position. So we turned around, and what we did was we summarized everything that they said and how they said about it until the terrorist literally, the goal was his only response could possibly be, that's right. And when we summarized all this nonsense, and the terrorist literally said on the phone, that's right, we went from a $10 million ransom demand to zero in about 15 seconds. Took everything out of what they were saying. It literally went from $10 million to zero.
And he actually changed that? It was as simple as that? He just wanted you to understand that, the terrorists?
Yeah, in that case, and what it is people always ask for more than what they want. So, you know, the first goal of that really was to shrink whatever the demand was down. You know, I didn't expect it to completely go away. I just wanted, since everybody in every situation always asks for more than what they want, whether it's your car salesman or whether it's a terrorist in a kidnapping, all I was trying to do was shrink it down. As it turned out, it happened to shrink this particular negotiation down to nothing. And as we looked at it more and more, we began to see more breakthroughs, like crazy breakthroughs, when people were being unreasonable by getting them to say that's right.
Mm-hmm. Chris Voss is my guest. If you've just joined us, let me just remind our listeners, Chris, a former FBI lead hostage negotiator, has written a new book, Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, and I wanted to point out, you know, the subtle difference here, too, is you don't want them to say you're right. You got to get them to say that's right. You're right is what we get, what we want people to say. It's actually what we say when we want people to shut up and go away. And we say it to people that we want to preserve the relationship with, whether or not we're in love with them or whether or not they're a coworker. But we want them to just ease up on us, and we want them to feel good about leaving us alone.
Yeah.
And you know who the preeminent practitioners of the your right phrase are?
No.
Husbands.
Okay. You're right. Right?
Yeah, it works like magic.
Well, unless it has maybe the tone that I just delivered it in. I don't know, because we know. But anyway, go back to the Philippines in 2000. This is when an Islamic group, a militant group, took an American hostage and demanded $10 million. That's right, became a key turning point there. You also talk about in connection with that hostage taking, where you were a negotiator, a tactic called the illusion of control. Is that all tied up in that as well?
Well, and it is, because when somebody says that's right to you, what they've done is they pronounce what you just said as the unequivocal truth. I mean, it's an epiphany moment. It's the truth. And because of that, they embrace it, and they feel very much in control. The amount of control that they feel, and people who are control-based negotiators, once you can get them to feel in control, you got them. Because they completely drop their guard. They're willing to go in almost any direction because they feel so in control. And at that point in time, you can take them in directions that they didn't even expect, because if they're a control-based negotiator, which most people are, once they've got that feeling, they're very vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. You talk about going from looking for yes to that's right, but you also talk about no being very important, the flip side of getting to yes. That's this catchphrase that came to us a few years ago. William Fisher and, is it Roger Urey, yes about negotiation. So tell us about why getting to yes is not as important as no.
Well, the problem with yes is commitment. So every time you say yes, you get really worried about what you've just let yourself in for. And that worry distracts you, and you're also reluctant to go there. I call you on the phone and I say, would you like to make more money? You know that I'm trying to trap you.
Right.
And lawyers actually have a term for this. They call it cornering. Let's keep asking them yes questions till we've got them in a corner that they can't get out of. Well, nobody likes to be cornered. And if you corner somebody in a deal, what's going to happen is they're not going to follow through, which is why I believe in that yes is nothing without how. So we started experimenting with flipping it. If yes makes people really nervous, what happens when people say no? And we found out that no matter what the circumstances, when you say no, you just protected yourself, and you're now more open to conversation. You know, a real simple example that I ask everybody in your audience to try. Instead of when they call somebody on the phone, instead of saying, have you got a few minutes to talk, which is yes, and people are now worried about where this is going, say instead, is now a bad time to talk? And watch the huge difference that you get in people that you have interactions with. They'll be willing to listen to you immediately because they just protected themselves.
Uh-huh. And this is underlaid with scientific data?
We've got the scientific data that's out there now is getting kind of crazy, in that they're starting to pull wires in people's brains and do MRI imaging on the amygdala and what the emotional reactions are. What ends up happening most of the time, if we can calm these emotions and center people, the part of the amygdala, the electrical activity goes down. So we're starting to show this in reality, that this is in fact what hostage negotiators have come to know is in fact the truth. So there's some scientific data out there at it. By and large, my anecdotal evidence from our experiences is this is the closest thing to almost a centering reaction of anything that we use. Other stuff has a very high percentage of working. Nothing is perfect, but this is the closest to getting people calmed down of anything that we've seen.
Chris Voss is with us this hour, former FBI lead in hostage negotiator. Never Split the Difference, his new book. He's been involved in more than 150 kidnapping cases around the world in his two decades with the FBI. Let's talk a little bit about your involvement in bank robbery. And I think this, if I'm reading this right or understanding this correctly, mirroring is something that has to do also with sort of the emotional appeal. This was a Chase Manhattan bank robbery in 1993. And one of the quotes you have when you talk about this, and I'd like you to explain it as you explain this case and your involvement, you write, really smart people often have trouble being negotiators. They're so smart they think they don't have anything to learn.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? It's two things. First of all, they don't think they have anything to learn, so they don't see negotiation as an information gathering process, which it is. The first commodity you want in a negotiation is information, because knowledge is power. The other side is always going to have stuff that you don't know or that you could never find out. So you have to look at it as a learning process. And then secondly, really smart people just want to show off how smart they are. They love to show off how much they know, which means they enter a negotiation, all they want to do is talk instead of listen, and they're sure of everything that they're right about. Another words of wisdom to live by in a negotiation is never be so sure of what you want that you wouldn't take something better. Well, really smart people tend to be very sure of what they want, which means they're not good at taking something better in a negotiation because they're not there to gather information.
And in this specific bank robbery, the person you were talking to was blowing up like a smoke screen. He was trying to make you believe something was going on in the bank, and there were many more people involved than actually were, right?
Right, exactly. He was the classic business decision maker who's trying to hide how important he is. That was the first thing. And this is the cliche in business. If you're at a negotiation table with someone that will only use plural pronouns, we, they, them, I have to worry about the other guys, I've got a board I got to answer to. If he's constantly deferring his own authority, it means he's an extremely influential person and he's hiding it from you. He doesn't want you to corner him with a lot of yes questions. And that's exactly what this bank robber was doing in the bank in Brooklyn. He had designed the whole bank robbery. He actually had manipulated his guys. They thought they were going to rob a cash machine. They didn't know it was going to be a bank robbery. He also knew that if he took responsibility for what was going on and we caught him, he would face the worst prosecution. And secondly, he also knew that if he was most in charge of what was going on and we decided we had to shoot one of them, he was probably going to be the one we shot. So he was really clever at disguising his authority, his decision making.
Mm-hmm. Also, in this case, you used what you call the FM DJ voice in talking with him. Maybe you could do the FM DJ voice and also tell us what it's used for, why it's used.
Well, I don't know that I would ever use an FM DJ voice on you.
So
why would I ever do something as devious as that?
So it gets me relaxed. It makes me think I'm listening to jazz on public radio, maybe, huh?
Yeah. You know, actually what it does is, you know, it gives you the upper hand in a negotiation and it lets the other side know, you know, you totally believe in what you're saying and also that you are not going to be rattled. I mean, it's very close to what the best TV news anchors do, what the best NPR broadcasters do, because there's so much credibility in that voice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very powerful. And then interestingly enough, when I was talking about it once a few years ago, a psychologist who had hypnotherapy training said, you know, that's the first thing they taught us when we had to hypnotize people. So whatever level it works on, I know it works on about three levels simultaneously, and I'll take every edge that I can get.
You were also involved in a 2002 sniper case in Washington, D.C. Tell us about your involvement in that and how that ties in with some of the strategies you're teaching in this book.
Well, we looked at action as communication in that case of the snipers. I mean, early on—
Give us the outline of the case, if you could.
Well, there was a sniper that was— You know, at the time, we thought it was a sniper. It happened to be a sniper duo that was randomly killing people in the Washington, D.C. area.
This is the man, and was it his son or just a young man he'd befriended, right?
Yeah, it was an older guy and a younger man. The older guy had gotten sway, influence over him. You know, he finally found somebody that he could manipulate into doing something horrific, and they decided that I think they first started to amuse themselves, and then it occurred to them, you know, that they might be able to extort an entire region with this terrorism. They'd actually engaged in a couple shootings prior to the spree of shootings in the D.C. area, and nobody knew it was them. So when they got very specific about it, and then they started leaving written communications at the scene, we looked at their behavior as communication. You know, and there's an old saying, you know, actions speak louder than words. You know, what you're doing speaks so loudly in my ears that I can't hear what you're saying. So it's, again, action is communication, and it's taking the entire context. We call this contextual intelligence of everything that people do and say and see how it lines up. So as soon as we started looking at this violence as communication, well, communication means you're trying to get something. And they were, and we actually drew them into a couple of conversations, which not only contributed to them getting caught, but then at trial, these were key issues in showing consciousness of guilt, which is later on they wanted to say, well, we were crazy or I was under the influence. and we could show the interactions we had with them. They said, no, you were trying to get $10 million out of the D.C. metropolitan area, and you guys knew what you were doing. So it's again, looking at communication in much broader terms so that you know you're in a negotiation when you really are in one.
Was mirroring and tactical empathy also used in that case?
We absolutely used tactical empathy in the way we designed our communications with them because we knew they were listening to Chief Moose, who's a phenomenal law enforcement leader. He's kind of been forgotten through the years, but he was fantastic in that case. And as soon as we started feeding him very specific things to say in his press statements, which was respect, and we knew how when once you start showing the other side as particularly a despicable adversary, when you show them respect, again, you gain the upper hand on them. They don't expect it. It was actually one point in time that he was so respectful in the media that reporters accused him of it. They said, Chief, you're acting like you're actually being respectful of the snipers because they're trying to get him out of it. And he did a great ad lib. He looked down, and then he looked back at the reporters and said, my parents always taught me to be respectful, and the question went away. And we really drew them out based on what we coached Chief Moose to say in those press conferences.
Mm-hmm. And this is really, when I think about hostage negotiation and criminals, working with criminals is often what we see portrayed on a variety of crime series on TV. And usually it's, I mean, you can find that, but most often the negotiator is this trying to prove he's the baddest in town. And that doesn't work generally.
No, because you turn it into a fight, which makes no sense. I mean, we always took a deferential approach, and because there's great power in deference, it's amazing what you can get away with someone if you're deferential. And in the sniper case specifically, we had an internal negotiation with some of our commanders, and this is just like any negotiation at work. And I actually waited for our on-scene commander in a parking lot. First thing in the morning, I had a written document that I'd been working on all night. And, you know, I was as aggressive and as assertive as you could possibly be with this guy. I didn't even let him get into the office to get a cup of coffee. But I stopped him and I said, boss, I've got something to tell you you don't want to hear, which is extremely deferential and aggressive at the same time. And he said, okay. And we sat down and he read the document and he went through everything and he asked me a couple questions and I got my way. I got my way by being deferential and very assertive at the same time. So deference is very important. It allows you to be assertive.
Mm-hmm. We've got to go away just for a few minutes and come back. Chris Voss, please stay on the line. Did you learn all this growing up in Mount Pleasant?
Well, I learned a lot growing up in Mount Pleasant. I can tell you that. I learned an awful lot from my Iowa upbringing.
Okay. We'll talk about that when we come back. Also, some more strategies that Chris has in his new book, Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. Chris is, for two decades, he was an FBI lead hostage negotiator internationally. He's brought that experience to what we'll talk about in the next half hour, how we can apply it to our own lives, buying a car, asking for a raise, sitting around the dinner table and perhaps not wanting to have that conversation escalate to, well, you know where it goes often, hurt feelings often. We'll talk about that when we come back. Chris Voss, join our conversation with your questions about negotiations. 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour with Chris Voss. During his two decades with the FBI, he was involved in more than 150 kidnapping cases around the world. Some of them we remember from our news. He described them in our first half hour, serving as a lead international hostage negotiator for the FBI. Now he's one of the leading practitioners and professors of negotiation skills in the world. He is the founder and principal of the Black Swan Group. It's a consulting firm that provides training and advises Fortune 500 companies through complex negotiations. He teaches at the University of Southern California, also at Georgetown University. His book, Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. We're learning from his experience in the FBI and also in the meantime about this half hour about how those negotiating tactics, strategies may be able to help us when we're doing more everyday things instead of freeing hostages. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, or email, tweet us at IPRTalk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Chris is a native of Mount Pleasant and also a graduate of Iowa State University. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the hour. So, broadly speaking, before we get into a few more of your strategies, Chris, how is hostage negotiation anything like the situation most people face in their daily lives with negotiation?
Yeah, what does it have to do with us? Because, I mean, people rarely have to talk to others who don't want to listen, do they? I mean, people, none of us in our day-to-day lives have to deal with somebody who's so intent on what they want that they won't listen to what we have to say. I know that's a crazy idea.
Oh, well, you've got to meet my teenagers. Maybe you've had some of your own at a certain point. We can start there, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a great example, because, like, the killer question for us to get the upper hand in hostage negotiations was a combination of a couple of how questions. We'd say, you know, how do we know that Ben is still alive if Ben happened to be the hostage? And then how are we supposed to pay you if we don't know Ben's alive? I mean, how are we supposed to do that? And one of my friend of mine recently was negotiating with their 13-year-old because the 13-year-old wanted mom to buy a $60 game console. And mom looked at him and she said, how am I supposed to do that? And immediately the 13-year-old went, okay, so I'll pay for half of it. So he dropped his demand immediately.
You, in your book, you discourage compromise. You just had an example of it, but you say just go for everything you want. Why?
Well, you know, there's a difference between a high-value trade and a compromise. And the best compromises are typically like, look, I've got a gray suit on today, and I can't decide whether or not I want to wear black shoes. You think I ought to wear brown shoes, so let's compromise. I'll wear one black and one brown. That's the way compromise works out most of the time. I'm going to take a little bit of your idea. I'm going to take a little bit of my idea.
Okay.
We're going to put them together, and neither will work. So compromise, if you just take a little extra time to find out actual best fit, or, you know, the problem is I may be completely right. And if I just talk to you in a nice enough way, if I respect you, if I do a tactical application of empathy, which is what I talk about in my book, not just empathy, but tactically understanding the dynamics of what's going on here. You know, I can completely get my way, and you're not going to have a problem with it because I heard you out. You felt respected. We didn't compromise at all.
Mm-hmm. And is this also what you're talking about when you talk about bending reality? And the person you're negotiating with isn't always or often not even aware of it.
Yeah, exactly. And what bends reality is our perception of loss. You know, loss stings twice as much as an equivalent gain. If I take $5 out of your hand, that's going to hurt you more than it would as if I gave you $10. And most business negotiation is designed to pitch the gains. You know, here's what I've got. It's going to make you 20% better off. Well, it's completely irrational, but you're going to count what you have to pay for that as more than its actual value. So as soon as I understand that loss stings twice as much as an equivalent gain, I'll just say, look, if you don't do this, you're going to miss out. And this is what you're going to miss out on. Do nothing, and this is how it's going to cost you money. And I've immediately bent your reality, because instead of you thinking about gains, you're now thinking about losses. And I know that's a much harder cattle prod in your decision making.
Mm-hmm. When you first started employing these strategies that you'd learned at the FBI, you talk a little bit about how it came up against the academic understandings of negotiation there. Tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Well, it was a combination of, you know, our approach before was just really logical, strict logic based in many ways, or, you know, sort of wearing the other side down, which is kind of a contest, or, you know, it's pushing the other side around. And when I got up to Harvard, I mean, I thought that there was going to be natural and normal rules, and it was going to be very civilized. And I took my emotion-based approach, especially with, you know, the how am I supposed to do that? And I found that I was bowling them over on a regular basis. I mean, it's the first five pages of my book talks about when I was simulated negotiation with Bob Mnookin, the head of the program on negotiation at Harvard. He literally asked me, he says, what are you going to do in a negotiation? What's the secret to gaining everything that you want? I said, I'm going to ask open-ended questions. And he kind of laughed, you know, because he thought, well, that's stupid. I've heard of open-ended questions before. I'm thoroughly unimpressed with that. And he actually asked some other people to come watch. He said, that's all you're going to do? I said, yeah. You know, I said it innocently because I know where this is going. I'm just going to ask you some open-ended questions. And as soon as we got started, I knew I had that killer how question that was completely going to stop him in his tracks. And that, you know, that's how we made it work.
Okay, so translate some of this into our everyday world so that we can come away this hour with cheering your name, for one, and cheering the strategies that you have in your book, Never Split the Difference. Give some parents some negotiation advice. Teenagers especially often don't seem to react to rational logic. What strategies are there to disarm them? Let's give a concrete example to you to really test you out here. Parents everywhere struggle with teenagers who don't clean up after themselves. They leave their clothes laying around. They don't clean up dirty dishes. They have to be nagged about doing their chores. How do you approach that?
How am I supposed to give you permission to go out Friday night if you don't pick up your clothes? You know, you take what they want most of all, and you make what you want as a path to getting there. And you put it to them in a way where you've completely boxed them in and made them think. That's the design of a good how question, is to catch somebody off guard and make them think. And you just take the sequence of what they want and make what you want getting there as part of the path. And it's usually going to be a how question, because with your kids, what you're really trying to do is make them think. That's why you explain things to them. The problem is, generally speaking, to get something through somebody's head by explaining it to them, you have to say it at least 19 times. There's pretty solid data to that effect, and I'm sure we feel that way with our kids. Whereas if you ask the single question that makes them think, well, this interaction may take a little bit longer, it gets you off the gerbil wheel, and you don't have to have it 19 times.
Mm-hmm. What about negotiations with a spouse or a partner? Anything different there?
Well, not different, but just a little bit more respectful and being willing to say stuff, because you know your partner's mad at you, and that might be unfair, but we're normally afraid to say that because we think it's going to make things worse. And in reality, and that was where the real test of this was, because I used to say, you sound angry, and it would calm people down. And I said, you sound angry, to my wife at the time, and she blew up like a nuclear explosion because she was blaming me for what was going on. I needed to go deeper in my understanding. And when I recognized that it wasn't just you sound angry, it's because, you know, it seems like I've been a real jerk this whole time, which a lot of people wouldn't want to say. But from their perspective, it is. And when you recognize how they feel about you and you're not afraid of it, that fearlessness actually encourages a relationship and calms them down quite a bit.
How do men and women negotiate differently, if they do? What's your experience?
You know, I think actually women tend to pick this style of negotiation up more quickly than men. And I think women are socialized to be more sympathetic, and it's a shorter step from sympathy to empathy. And it's an intuitive understanding of what's driving the other side. And I think women are much more socialized. I can't say that you know, by nature, but by nurture, I think there's more emphasis on it. I think men, on the other hand, are socialized to say no more and to be able to turn and walk away or to cut negotiations off. And I think if you can put those two things together, I think men need to get better and intuitive understandings of other people, and women need to be encouraged to say no more and to say it in different ways, because how am I supposed to do that is another way of saying no. And I think when you can combine either of these two characteristics, you've got a really dangerous negotiator.
Chris Voss is with us for the hour, former FBI lead negotiator, hostage negotiator. Never Split the Difference. Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It is his new book. What his experience as a hostage negotiator can tell us about our everyday negotiations. How do you handle, Chris, a really aggressive negotiator? We've all encountered them. They're unpleasant. We don't like these encounters. Someone who wants what they want and doesn't seem like they'll settle for any less.
Well, you know, I think the classic is the way Paul Ryan is interacting with Donald Trump. I think that's a classic example. Because Donald Trump, and I have a tremendous amount of respect and admiration for Mr. Trump, he likes a good fight. It energizes him. He likes it when the other side fights back, and then the fight seems to go on and on and on and on. And Paul Ryan, on the other hand, is not interested in getting drawn into a fight. He doesn't react in the same way. And in my view, it kind of catches Donald Trump off guard, and he actually likes that. He has a tremendous amount of respect for it. The similar type of negotiation with Mr. Trump on a regular basis. I was reading an article about his son-in-law the other day, and his son-in-law doesn't fight openly. He takes very much more the Paul Ryan approach to him, and you can see how glowingly Mr. Trump refers to his son-in-law when he talks about him in the media. So the really aggressive negotiator is not best dealt with by being equally combative. The really aggressive negotiator actually respects a counterpart that keeps their cool and uses the late night FM DJ voice and just doesn't get rattled. Because the aggressive negotiator wants to see if they can rattle you. And if you don't get rattled and you don't give in, they actually have a tremendous amount of respect for you and they want to deal with you. That's exactly the way we handle kidnappers internationally, the same type of approach.
Can you tell, Chris, which of the current presidential candidates has better negotiating skills?
Well, a lot of it is contextual. I like the stealth approach that Hillary Clinton seems to employ with great effect.
The stealth approach.
She's very subtle. I don't think anybody could say that Hillary Clinton gives in, and she talks about empathy all the time. Of all the things that you would accuse Hillary Clinton of, I haven't anybody seen the accusation or the description of weak in any way, shape, or form, whether you're in favor of her or you're her worst critic. She has a very tactical approach in her negotiations. She's not afraid of the word empathy, and she seems to be very good at getting her way. The unfortunate residue of the openly combative approach of Mr. Trump is you leave a line of people that are looking forward to getting you back and paying you back. And in international collaboration, that's not a great legacy.
Mm-hmm. We're coming up on about 5 minutes left of this fascinating conversation with you, Chris Voss. Tell us about Black Swan. You lead the founder and principal of the Black Swan Group. You named your group after this strategy, I guess. What are Black Swans?
Well, Black Swans are little pieces of information that if you could get your hands on them, if you could learn them, are going to make all the difference in the world. And it's also subtle, innocuous ways to negotiate that the other side has no idea that you're steering the negotiation and it makes a massive difference in the negotiation.
Can you give us an example that we would relate to?
That you can relate to?
An example of a black swan.
So first of all, what I just did to you was I mirrored you a little bit to get you to talk a little bit more.
Okay.
So I apologize for using a negotiator, but that's a skill because you just added to it a little bit more and you talked a little bit more in the interaction. And that's a black swan skill. It's very subtle. And I could tell from your tone of voice that you thought it was part of the conversation. When in fact, what I did was buy myself a little bit of time in the conversation and give myself a chance to think.
Mm.
It's the way we buy time in a negotiation without the other side seeing that we're actually slowing things down so that we can hear more. I'm looking for more in your tone of voice. I'm looking for more of you feeling relaxed. I'm looking to actually get you more interested in the next thing that I'm going to say when I do speak. And that was what that mirror was designed to do. So in any given negotiation, there's probably something personal involved with you that I would never guess, but I'd have to hear it. And that might make all the difference in the world. And the greatest example that I can think of recently is, I'm drawing a mental blank on his name, the pro basketball player from the Oklahoma City Thunder that just signed with the Golden State Warriors, Kevin Durant.
Durant, right.
You know, and in his statement recently about why he signed with the Warriors, he makes several things in his statement about how it's going to help him in his development as a man. Now, what pro basketball team, you know, the Boston Celtics were after him, the Miami Heat were after him, the Los Angeles Clippers were after him. Somebody with the Golden State Warriors in their conversations with Durant heard something that he said, and they got Kevin Durant away from every other franchise in the NBA. And they heard something about what Durant said about being a better man. And none of those, I guarantee you, none of those teams in their preparations ahead of time said, well, we're going to tell Kevin Durant that if he plays for us, he's going to be a better man. Right. They would actually probably think that's insulting. But if you read what Durant said, that kind of personal individual development was why the Warriors made the difference in their approach. And yes, money's involved, and yes, championships are involved. But Durant's looking for his legacy as a human being and how he's going to be remembered. And that made all the difference in the world.
Chris Voss, we've got 3 or 4 minutes left. I want to ask you for sure about growing up here in Iowa in Mount Pleasant. You graduated from high school in Mount Pleasant in 1976, I understand, from Iowa State University in 1980 with a degree in industrial administration. Looking back on your youth, in hindsight, do you see how the type of kid you were and life you led as a kid led you to a career as a hostage negotiator?
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, I grew up in a blue-collar entrepreneurial family where, you know, the small-town Iowa attitude is, look, we got stuff we have to get done. Let's figure it out and let's get to it. And I think that's the classic approach for negotiation. I mean, here's what's in front of us. Let's use our common sense. Let's work hard at this. Let's kind of have fun while we're doing it. You know, hard work can be a lot of fun. Let's work with people that we like working with and respect. And let's get the job done. Let's figure it out. I think that's how I grew up in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, and I think that's the key to any negotiation.
Was there a point in time when you discovered this particular career passion for negotiation? Was there a moment when a switch clicked on and you went, wow, this is what I want to dedicate my life to?
Well, it happened much later when I was in New York City. I mean, I was volunteering on a suicide hotline, and in very short periods of time, we figured out ways to get through to people emotionally, just to settle them down and to help them get their feet back under them and accomplish problems and solve problems. And I think that resonated with me very much in the way that I'd grown up with in Iowa. Like, this is powerful stuff. And this helps people, and it actually works in day-to-day life. And I think that's really where it came from.
Mm-hmm. Where is negotiation going? We talked at the beginning of the hour about a big turning point from logic-based approaches to more emotional, intelligence-based approaches. Have we learned everything there is about negotiating? Is there some more science there that we have yet to discover?
Yeah, I think there's a lot more. I think there's a lot that's going to validate. We're continuing to validate this emotional intelligence approach. The nice thing now, you know, emotional intelligence is recognized as an essential ingredient to success in business. You know, they say that you get hired based on your IQ, you get promoted based on your EQ, your emotional intelligence. And I think we're continuing to discover that, especially as our society becomes more productive. And by and large, I think as more and more women get in at every single level of our society, that advances how smart we are and makes what we're capable of accomplishing in any business much greater, as more and more women help us understand how to get smarter.
Mm-hmm. Are you still learning about negotiation with all these years of experience, Chris?
Yeah, all the time, all the time. Learning new ways that it applies, learning that, you know, the same ideas that work in Iowa work in India, because we're human beings and we're driven by the same stuff. So it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy it.
Okay, Chris, we've had a wonderful hour with you. Thank you for spending the time. For two decades, Chris Voss served as the lead international hostage negotiator for the FBI. He's now teaching at a University of Southern California, also at Georgetown University. He's founder and principal of the Black Swan Group, a consulting firm that helps Fortune 500 companies through complex situations. Never split the difference. His book, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. Chris, thanks for joining us this hour. Really enjoyed talking with you about your career.
And it was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me on.
All right. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Graham Bly. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.